good morning and afternoon and good night. All that good day to everybody. This is your host, DJ Synergy, and you're joining me for the next hour on Culture Crossover, where I talk about the indie and pop culture news that's worth hearing about. So over the next hour, I'll be chatting with you on current issues causing uproar for the entertainment industry. In our first segment, All in the Gray, the next segment, Drowning in the Mainstream, we're going to talk a little bit about some indie sub countercultures. And I have a lot of stories going on with that, especially with the last 2 weeks of Coachella, which have lots of stories with that. And in our last segment, we will give a little attention to some viral news that is causing buzz around the globe. And again, this is DJ Synergy, and you're joining me for Culture Crossover. So let's get into it. The first story I have for you today is on the new 3D animated movie that will be coming out later this year in November. It's called Home, and it will have the first lead of a black character that has in all of our history, which is pretty significant, I would say. And so in November, DreamWorks Home, based on Adam Rex's book, The True Meaning of Smeck Day, will be the first. The film features Rihanna's vocals portraying a teenage girl named Tip, Jim Parsons lending his voice to an alien named O, Jennifer Lopez as Tip's mother, and Steve Martin as Captain Smeck, the leader of the boy alien race. Here is a synopsis taken from IndieWire. When Earth is taken over by the overly confident boy, an alien race is in search of a new place to call home. All humans are promptly relocated while the boy get busy efficiently reorganizing the planet. But when one resourceful girl, Tip, or Rihanna's voice, manages to avoid capture, she finds herself the accidental accomplice of a banished boy by the name of O, Jim Parsons. Equally stubborn and set in their ways, these two fugitives realize there's a lot more at stake than intergalactic relations as they embark on the road trip of a lifetime. Good thing they have a flying car. In addition to starring in Home, Rihanna is set to record an accompanying album. Check out a prequel short called Almost Home, which is available on YouTube. It's a pretty good preview, I would say. It's definitely going to be one of those movies kind of like Despicable Me 2, where it has a pretty significant underlining story to it, but it's also just a ton of family fun and everything, and something to definitely enjoy for all. I just think the best part is that there's going to actually be a black character lead, because we haven't had that, especially since it's going to be female. That's even more empowering. And so that is just the first thing to start off today with a little positive note. My next story is also a little bit in that will like make the audience in cahoots. It's the head attached to the impossibly chiseled rig of Channing Tatum visited the Bastion of Pomp, a tradition known as the MTV Movie Awards, just the other day. After picking up the Trailblazer Award, given to a young actor with a body of work that is deemed diverse and a public reputation that is transcendent, for the record, Tatum is about 11 years older than the award's previous two recipients in Emma Stone and Emma Watson, but that's neither here nor there. And somehow, in the middle of all that excitement, he's managed to drop a tasty little tidbit of information about the upcoming sequel to the gloriously sweaty, gyrational, glistening, cinematic achievement known as Magic Mike. So Magic Mike, for those of you who don't know, is about male strippers, and it is one of those kind of chick flicks, I would say, where, you know, it's just something fun to watch, but it's also very entertaining, and it can be a little bit exploitative of all of the men and that are showcasing their bodies, I would say. But it's all in good fun and jest and everything. There's no point where it gets so serious that, you know, you really get too worried about it. And so the sequel, which will be titled Magic Mike XXL, and has been penned from the godly hands of Tatum himself, is going to be a road movie. But maybe not in the traditional sense of previous films that fit that ilk. So Tatum commented on the movie, and I thought it was pretty interesting to hear his words on it. And he says, we don't want to make it some serious slice of life movie. We want to have real, like, reality in it, but we don't want to make, like, some dark drama. There was some darkness in the last movie, and I think it surprised people and shocked people. This one, we want to have a lot of conflict and a lot of struggle, but we also want there to be a lot of fun. A lot of fun of ridiculous stuff that you would never see in a movie on the face of the earth ever again. And so you can tell that by the project. It's just all in good fun and everything, but you can't really help but think, wow, why are we so entertained by all of these men showcasing their bodies in such a vulnerable way? And so I think that is a good discussion to be brought up, but I'm definitely excited to be watching this just because I love all the actors who are in it, like Matthew McConaughey. I love his acting, and same with Channing Tatum. I really just generally like seeing their work and everything, even if it is a little racy. Up next for my stories are one about the Coachella weekend, which was very warmly welcoming of Pharrell. And Pharrell is just an artist who is, he's been in the rap industry for such a long time now. He is one of the most cherished rappers in this industry, but then also he has, like, there wasn't a lot of hype about him up until recently with his release of Happy and now his new album Girl, which I absolutely adore. And so far, what everyone was saying about the Coachella was just that he completely rocked it. He was doing great, and there's just no stopping Pharrell. For his Encore Weekend 2 performance, the Get Lucky singer proved once again that he could bring it out, or he could bring out the biggest talent that he's worked with over the years to put on one heck of a show, sharing the stage with none other than Jay-Z, Usher, T.I., Pusha T, Busta Rhymes, and the Jabberwockies. After Diddy, Nelly, Diplo, Snoop Dogg, Busta, and Gwen Stefani all joined him last weekend, fans knew there was a good chance that some of Pharrell's famous friends would be there this time around as well to help out. And this time, his voice wasn't battling a sandstorm. "I don't know what you're on, but I hope it's happy," Pharrell said to the cloud. "It's just me and you and the desert. The desert got me last week, but not this week, baby." Pharrell's first guest came early in the form of T.I., who joined in as a featured rapper on Robin Thicke's 2013 anthem, Blurred Lines. Next up, Pusha T hopped on to sing Grindin', then Busta was back once again on Pass the Kerfuzier. And I'm really, really excited to be seeing Pharrell perform again and everything, because I remember hearing him a couple years ago and I just totally adored his work. And now I'm glad that he is putting on such great shows for everyone to enjoy. I actually watched a stream of his performances and I thought he was just doing great for 41 years old. And that was after Busta Rhymes. It was followed up by the next big appearance, Usher, who joined in on You Don't Have to Call. "You're not going to believe this guy's new album coming out this summer," Pharrell told the crowd, referring to Usher at one point as his brother. The Vegas-based troupe, Jabberwockies, then performed a routine to the Swedish House Mafia track One. But Pharrell saved the best for last, as none other than the king himself, Jay-Z, came out to the and the crowd went wild. The duo performed I Just Want to Love You, Give It to Me, which was the highlight of the night set and Coachella's second weekend's second night overall. Jay-Z performed Dead Presidents during Coachella's first weekend alongside rapper Nas, who himself would later celebrate the 20th anniversary of his magnum opus album, Illmatic. And as the next act on the same outdoor theater stage, which Pharrell performed on. Throughout the evening, Pharrell gave shout-outs to Queen Latifah, Andre 3000, Outkast, and Haim, all of whom were watching from the artist viewing area. I think it's really important to bring up that there's just such a great bond of family with people who have been in the industry for such a long time, and I think that because Coachella is so close to where everyone lives, everyone goes out there to support everyone and make it just the most fun that anyone could ever have, I would say. I'm so jealous that I wasn't there this weekend or even the weekend before. I definitely wish that I would have been, because it just seems like such a great atmosphere to be inside of. In addition, it's common for Coachella festival goers to stumble upon an act they didn't know previously that ends up absolutely blowing their minds. So this Saturday, for this particular writer, the act was DJ live music act Galantis, which consists of Swedes Christian Carlson of Mike Snow and Linus Eklo, otherwise known as Style of I. The band's DJ set in the Gobi tent was one of the day's best, a high-energy dance set with live percussion that many people were overheard saying was their favorite of Saturday. The duo's good friend Cascade even joined them on stage at one point to dance alongside his remix to their new single, Smile. On Saturday, there was also a little bit of a peek behind the curtain of the Sahara tent to talk with one of the people responsible for putting it all together. So, video production guru Velo Verkos of V Squared Labs, who was recently named number 35 of Rolling Stone's list of the 50 most important people in EDM, Velo handles most of the screen visuals for over 15 of the biggest EDM festivals in the world, putting a 16-plus hour days at Coachella to put it all together. And so that was a little bit on Coachella. I have a couple more stories following, but for that, I really wish that everyone could experience it. It's just, if for anyone who loves music and just loves having a good time with their friends, it's got to be some kind of, just kind of a changing experience, I would expect it to be. Well, moving on, I have another story, which is really, really interesting for my perspective anyways, but a survey was conducted earlier this month by JWT, a Globian advertising firm, and provided exclusively to BuzzFeed, and reveals how American consumers feel about seeing gay and lesbian people in advertisements. A new market research study conducted exclusively for BuzzFeed by JWT reveals key insights on how American consumers react to LGBT-inclusive advertisements. The results come as major American brands like Honey Maid, Coca-Cola, and Chevrolet have concluded that featuring same-sex couples and their families in mass marketing campaigns help them sell products to the average American consumer. This is exactly what I've been talking about all semester with the Honey Maid commercial, where there was an interracial couple, the gay couple, and then someone was a foster mother or something, and it had negative feedbacks with it, of course, but overall so many people were so accepting of it, and it's just great to see that most people are now they're pushing for advertisement and they're okay with the advertising of lesbian and gay couples in ads. And the survey results are very useful in revealing that the vast majority of Americans, which is 80%, feel that showing LGBT characters in ads simply reflects the reality of society today, said Mark Truss, Director of Brand Intelligence at JWT. We also know that ads can often serve as a beacon for societal norms. These findings suggest that when diversity and acceptance are authentic and on strategy for the brand, LGBT-inclusive ads will be met with a high degree of acceptance and benefit the advertiser. 6 in 10 consumers agree brands that show same-sex couples in ads are being appropriately inclusive, according to the survey. Slightly fewer respondents, or 57%, agreed with the statement that it's cool when I see same-sex couples in ads. Most American consumers believe brands that feature same-sex couples in advertising are brave and modern. Overall, 72% of respondents said they view brands with such ads as brave, which in the advertising and marketing world translates to leadership. I think all these statistics are so positive and so great to hear, and kind of relieving in a way, because there is always such a fight against not changing and not, you know, losing tradition and advertisement because it will lose a piece of our history or whatever. But it's so cool that there is actual research showing that people are okay with it and accepting of it, and that there can be change, and it can come at any time, really. So slightly fewer respondents, or 57%, agreed with the statement that it's cool when I see same-sex couples in ads. Most American consumers believe brands that feature same-sex couples in advertising are brave and modern. And 71% of respondents agreed with the statement, gay, lesbian, black, white, tall, short, who cares who brands show in ads. However, a segment of the population, or 40% of the respondents, indicated TV ads are no place for same-sex couples. Most of these respondents identified themselves as men, conservative, religious, and from older generations. And I think that we can all agree that this is something that we all see, and we all know that there is a definite divide of the conservative men who think that it's so strange and foreign for a man to love another man, or a woman to love another woman, or anything like that, for anyone to go out of what is accepted or what was traditionally accepted 100 years ago is not what it is to this day. And so it doesn't surprise me that men, conservative, religious, and from old generations thought that TV ads were no place for same-sex couples. So how overtly or prominently gay and lesbian people are featured in the ads makes a difference in how the ads are received. According to reactions from respondents when they were shown examples, an ad for Target's wedding gift registry featuring a same-sex couple holding hands and lightly embracing was viewed as more controversial than an Amazon Kindle television ad in which a man refers to another as his husband. Specifically, 61% viewed the Target ad as controversial, while only 28% found the Kindle ad controversial. Further, 84% of respondents said they liked the Kindle ad, while only 48% said they liked the Target ad. The Kindle ad was also more relevant to respondents. Most Americans, though, have not been exposed to mass marketing campaigns featuring gay and lesbian couples, the survey found. The data showed us that only a minority of Americans, which is 36%, see ads featuring members of the LGBT community, which I think is kind of shocking that less than half of the population of Americans see these ads. So you really get to thinking then, where are these ads displayed, which are probably places like New York and California, where they're a lot more liberal. And so when you really think about the survey, it is mostly positive, but it also is showing that there are extremely limited populations of where people are in support of this, and the respondents were most likely people who live in demographic areas that are in support of same-sex couples. And so that finishes off our first segment. I think it was pretty interesting. I hope that you all agree. We are going to take a quick station break, but then after, I will be back to discuss drowning in the mainstream. I hope that you all stay tuned.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier. She left here last early spring. Is living there, I hear. Say for me that I'm alright.
Hello all, this is DJ Synergy. I just wanted to take a short second to explain to you all that tomorrow I will be interviewing alongside DJ Hafo. We will be interviewing Paul Racanello from 4 to 5, so tune in. We're going to ask him all that we can about student affairs, and it'll be a really fun discussion. he'll be on, he'll come on around 4:15, between 4:15 and 4:30, and it'll be a quick, short segment, but it's definitely something to tune in to on Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. Thank you.
And though our separation, it pierced me to the heart, she still lives inside of me. We've never been apart. If you get close to her, kiss her once for me. Always have respected her for doing what she did and getting free. Oh, whatever makes her happy, I won't stand in the way.
Hello, hello, listeners. Welcome back. This is DJ Synergy on Culture Crossover. We just got back from a short break where I explained to you that there will be an interview of Paul Racanello tomorrow on Penguin Radio from 4 to 5 p.m. Make sure that you set aside some time to tune in. We'll be asking him all that he knows about student affairs, a little bit of personal life, and what he sees as the future of Dominican. And we are going to move right along to Drowning in the Mainstream. My first story for you is in regards to Game of Thrones, which is an amazing show, by the way. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely look into it. Even the books I know are amazing. I have not read them, but they are something to put on your summer reading list when you have nothing better to do than read and tan outside. And what the story is surrounding is last week's episode, which was the second episode in the fourth season. And this is it was titled The Lion and the Rose, and it has unsurprisingly broken torrent records for the most people sharing a file simultaneously via BitTorrent, with 193,418 Wiley internet users sharing a single file and 1.5 million people downloading the game-changing episode in the first day alone. Wow, that is amazing. I think, well, yeah, first of all, it's pretty illegal to be downloading a video and watching it without, you know, consent and everything. But it's crazy that so many people are in demand of watching it, that there was such a high record. And I think that's just proves to the public that it is an amazing show. It has a great storyline, which is complex and intriguing at both the same time. You can get a little lost if you're not paying full attention to it, but definitely watch it or even read the books. I'm sure that they're both phenomenal alone and together. And according to the Torrent Freak, these are unprecedented numbers that convincingly exceed last year's record-setting milestone when 171,572 people shared a single tracker for the third season finale of Game of Thrones. It's no shocker that it was also a Game of Thrones episode where there was a ton of file sharing. This reportedly makes Game of Thrones a forerunner for the prestigious honorific of the most pirated show at the year's end, which, I mean, it's something that you don't exactly want to be taking credit for, but at the same time, it's just so awesome. And that was all I really wanted to say about it, other than the gripping storyline is so amazing, and it's fantasy and action, and it's just everything that you can imagine a great show to be. My next story, we're going back to Coachella. We're going back to Coachella for a little bit to discuss the event organizers. So the event organizers released the timetables for the three-day event, and along with the usual head-scratching dilemma of bands you'd like to see clashing, they've managed to slip a couple of surprises that they've somehow managed to keep really, really quiet. Along with headliners, the reunited Outkast, which I'm so excited that they're reunited because they're just such a great band, Muse and the Canadian Darlings, the Arcade Fire, you'll notice a couple of names not seen on the posters prior to the now legendary Pixies, along with Stroker, Julian Casablancas. The festival runs twice over two consecutive weekends and includes a phenomenally stacked lineup, which includes appearances by Australian legends Flume and Empire of the Sun, as well as our much-beloved little Kiwi sister Lorde, alongside big names like The Replacements, Queens of the Stone Age, Pharrell Williams, Beck, Foster the People, Pet Shop Boys, Neutral Milk Hotel, and Motorhead. Whilst the whole thing taking place way over in California, for most people that's very, very far, but I'm lucky to be a resident of California, and I still didn't go, which I'm kind of bummed about. But moving on, those who were not lucky enough to attend were granted gracefully with live stream options. And I think if you're into music and you like all those bands, you should totally just try and live the weekend through your computer screen, because it is still a really good show even if you're watching it through your computer screen. Next on my stories, we have a pretty interesting one, I'd say, and it regards the Salesforce CEO, Mark Benioff, whose company just inked a deal that includes naming rights for what's going to be the tallest building west of the Mississippi. And he has no patience for his peers who take a greedy, purely capitalistic approach to doing business in hyper-liberal San Francisco. San Francisco is such a highly crazy, amazing, economically driven city, and I love it. I love that I live near it and that I can be at the park, at the Golden Gate Park, or I can go to the zoo, and I can all go spend the day, and it's just a day, and I feel like I am just completely submerged in the culture. But there's also so much that goes on within San Francisco that I don't think we really realize. So in an interview with San Francisco Magazine, he talks about SF Gives, the effort he launched to raise $10 million from tech companies to combat poverty in San Francisco. He also talks about why San Francisco is probably always going to be an expensive place to live. Benioff points out that even though San Francisco has a historically countercultural spirit, it's often been a city of dramatic economic booms, and big companies have always played major roles in creating its fabric, from Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Levi's among them. But tied into that, he says, has always been generosity, the Haas family, the Hellmans, the Fishers, the Shornsteins. During every one of these boom times, the people who benefited the most were also giving back the most. He's called on other companies to give between $500,000 to $1 million to his SF Gives campaign, and so far, he's signed up a dozen of them, including Google, Levi's, LinkedIn, and PopSugar. And he seems to be on a mission to create a counter-narrative to the Google bus and eviction protests that are grabbing so many headlines lately. He says, I say, if you want to be in this city and take advantage of all this great infrastructure, our mass transit, our schools, our hospitals, the safety and stability that we have, then also give back. I think he's making a great argument, because I know that in my historical town of Petaluma, where I grew up, there's so much donations that were going on there because it was a town that totally boomed, and the beneficiaries and the benefiters and everything, they were totally on the same level, and they were making a active movement towards creating a better city. And I think that's exactly what Benioff is trying to argue for. He says, I say, if you want to be in the city and take advantage of all this great infrastructure, our mass transit, our schools, our hospitals, the safety and stability that we have, then also give back. I read that one more time just so that you could hear it, because I kind of went off on a tangent. But it's something that you should really think about. And what would you do if you had all that money? Would you keep it all for yourself? And would you spend it on vacations and a bunch of materialistic things? Or would you do it for the benefit of your future generation? San Francisco has a generous spirit, an innovative spirit, and it's a beautiful spirit, a loving spirit. Those are the things that mark what SF is really all about. So regarding the eviction protests and the general angst about rents and gentrification, well, if you go to the great cities in the world, Tokyo, New York, Paris, London, they all have these same issues. If you want to buy an apartment near the Eiffel Tower, it's going to be expensive, and that's because there is such a want to be the owner of that property, and so because that they can rise prices and people will buy it, that's why that happens, that's capitalism, and yada yada. But because of that, the mayor and the leaders of the city need to work hard to regulate the changes. And in regards to Mark Zuckerberg's recent $1 billion donation to the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, a group of donor-advised funds, or DAFs, that has no specific obligation to distribute its money. So you see, Zuckerberg's gift was more of a write-off than a donation. Where is it gone? What good is it doing now? I'm sure his intentions were positive, but we need to see the money get distributed. What are his targets? What are his philanthropic interests? We know that he has a political interest with his 501c, but where are his philanthropic interests? I'm sorry that I'm struggling over that word so much, but I think that Benioff is making a great argument. We need to have a city and a world where we're all working towards benefiting each other in the grand scheme of things. For my next story, we are going to move on to a little bit of a palate pleaser, I would say. And spring is usually a season for the new stuff in San Francisco food scene, and this year is no exception. As our local economy continues to boom, 2014 is shaping up to be a very busy year for Bay Area food and drink scribes. Not to mention the Yelp elite who clamored to be the first to review everything. Below, a collection of new bars and restaurants quickly coming your way. As Easter noted yesterday, including the revamp of Schroeder's that we talked about earlier this week, there are at least a dozen new things on the radar and getting set to open, though not all of them have official opening dates yet. These are the big ones we should be aware of. So Magnolia's Dog Patch Brewery and Smokestack, everyone's been waiting impatiently for this one for a couple years now, since it was first announced. But brewmaster Dave McLean is finally ready to debut his expansion to Dog Patch, which will have a full-scale brewery operation, tap room, and barbecue restaurant called Smokestack, led by Namugaji's Dennis Lee. The next one up is a pretty interesting one, and it's called Urban Putt. So we told you about this super exciting thing last week, but just a reminder, this mini golf course with attached restaurant and cocktail bar is coming your way May 5th, and there will be deep dish pizza. That'll be located on 1096 South Van Ness Avenue at 22nd, 4505. So burgers and barbecue, 405 meat. Oh, I'm sorry. I misread that. And so for burgers and barbecue, 4505 meats, which has long had a presence at farmers markets and now has a small butcher shop at the Mission and 15th, will now have a little restaurant to call their own, serving the famous 4505 burger, as well as some probably awesome barbecue. They've moved into former DePitt Brothers barbecue space on Divis, and they're set to start serving food for takeout on May 3rd. Patio seating and dining will launch later. At 705 Divisadero at Groves Aveline, we talked about this one last year, and it's the first Bay Area restaurant project from Top Chef alum Casey Thompson, who's actually been living here and up in Napa for the past 6 years. Named in honor of both her grandmothers, one of whom was French, the menu promises refined casual fare with some inventive combinations of ingredients like crispy chicken skins with charred onion, eggplant, and trout roe. And Wagyu beef with fat back and cheese toast. Also, there will be an attached cocktail bar dubbed the European. So those are just some of the new things that are coming out on the scene of the foodies for San Francisco. And we are going to take a quick break and we'll be back soon. Don't go away. This is DJ Synergy. I'm so happy to be hosting you all. And don't you dare touch anything. Just stay here. Keep listening to music. Yay.
Seems to hang on so tight. Come quickly now, the air hangs heavily today. Oh no, what is that crimson in the shade? Oh la, we've got a lot to know from each other, we have got to sleep together.
Everybody, I am DJ Synergy, and we are back for the last segment, Virality. And I'm going to first start off with kind of a somber story, which is about Mark Collins Rector, who allegedly hosted parties where he, Brian Singer, and others sexually abused teenage boys, was sued in 2000 by three people for sexual abuse. One of them was Alexander Burton, who played Pyro in the first X-Men movie. Alexander Burton, the actor who played Pyro in the first X-Men film, was a plaintiff in a 2000 sexual abuse lawsuit against Mark Collins Rector, a registered sex offender and former executive of Digital Entertainment Network, or DEN, who allegedly threw parties at his Encino, California mansion, where Bryan Singer and other men who worked in the entertainment industry provided drugs and alcohol to teenage boys and sexually abused and threatened them. Singer has denied the allegations. Attorney Jacob Arash Shabazz, who represented the plaintiffs, told BuzzFeed Friday that the 2000 case, which was filed in the Los Angeles Superior Court July of that year, was over alleged sexual abuse and was settled confidentially. But according to the case docket obtained by BuzzFeed, the three were awarded $2,030,000. In a judgment and $1 million in accrued interest in 2011. Shabazz did not immediately respond to questions what those judgments were for, whether they were paid by the defendant and whether they were separate from the settlement. One of the other plaintiffs in 2000 was Michael Egan, who this week filed suit against Singer in a Hawaii federal court alleging Singer sexually abused him on the multiple occasions. This is such sad news to hear of people who are totally abusing people in the industry of film and entertainment, and it blows my mind that anyone would do these sort of things. And it goes on to explain in the article that Singer would give people certain roles in honor of sexual favors that he would receive from them, and that was his way of totally manipulating everyone into his control and controlling what he said was he was basically saying that he owned Hollywood and that he could do whatever he wanted, and that if you did this for him, then he'll make it big for you. And amid the current controversy swirling around X-Men, Days of Future Past director Bryan Singer, sources confirmed to BuzzFeed that ABC will re-edit commercials for its new drama, Black Box, to remove any mention of Singer, the show's executive producer. When reached via email, ABC had no comment. Singer is the subject of a new lawsuit alleging he drugged and sexually abused a minor in 1999. Singer's lawsuit called the accusations absurd and defamatory. Black Box is scheduled to premiere April 24th. I think mainly it's all karma, because Singer, he's doing all these crazy cool projects and he's utilizing his talents. Yes, of course, he has done a great amount of work in his career, but he's also being accused for all of this sexual abuse, which is to say, or come to question, is it just these people looking for attention and for payoffs and stuff like that? Are they just trying to drag him down because they weren't as successful as they thought they would be when they first created relations with him? So it's all a really tipsy-turvy topic, and you know, it could really go either way for everybody. Either Singer did do what the people are complaining about, or they're just completely false myths and everything totally made up in honor to bring Singer down to where they're at. And the reason why I wanted to tell you this story was because it kind of segues into a post that I read over the weekend, and it is about another comment that Kirsten Dunst made. Now, I talked in my last show all about a comment she made about the traditional woman and how the women should be staying at home and how they're undervalued and that people really should not worry so much about women being independent because their roles are so important for bringing up their children and all sorts like that. That was her main message, and I'm not sure if the magazine was just twisting her words around. We never really know, but in the newest report of her really shocking and open statements, it kind of makes you think maybe she does have this mindset, and maybe her vision is sort of skewed in a way, because now she is putting it on people that if you are sexually abused in the industry, you're asking for it. And the last time we talked about Kirsten Dunst, it was because she said that women are better off cooking and cleaning, which is totally fine if that's what a woman wants, and it should not be because it's her rightful place, or any outdated sexist stuff like that. Today, she has some brand new views to share with us. Sofia Coppola, a frequent collaborator with her, interviewed Dunst for W Magazine. The two talked about their relationship and when shooting films. I feel like you and I are so on the same page about how to approach things. Have you ever worked with a director you didn't agree with? And if so, what did you do? Kirsten says, I have, and it takes all the fun out of what I do. You just get through it instead of having a meaningful experience. Then the things get weird. Coppola asks about handsy, creepy, pervy, whatever you want to call it, directors, and Dunst has a pretty awful answer to give, if I am saying so myself. So Coppola asks, what if a director pounces on you while working? Has it ever happened? Dunst responds, no, I don't give off that vibe. I think that you court that stuff. And to me, it's crossing a boundary that would hinder the trust in your working relationship. So Dunst believes that every actress who is sexually harassed by pervy directors in Hollywood and even actors, she's technically saying that they're all asking for it. And I just think that there is a lot of victim blaming with that. And Kirsten Dunst, she's made accusations that are way ahead of what I think she was meaning to say. I mean, you can get into the heat of an argument, and maybe because Coppola is a good friend, she kind of let it slide in her harsh wording of her response. But I think that to say that anyone who is sexually abused is asking for it, and especially in the industry where there's such high passion and everything, and stuff can totally go awry like very easily, but I don't think that it goes to say that they're asking for it. So that is one of the things that I think is not so much going viral as a meme or anything, but just to see these statements that Dunst is putting out, it's really just kind of everyone is looking at her with a very strange face on, I'd say. My next story is a little bit, I'd say, lighthearted, and it's all about Emma Stone, who is a wonderful comedian, I'd say. I love all of her acting work as well. She is going around on a tour to promote the new Spider-Man movie and all that. And this is just a really funny story. So Emma Stone traversed the entire Kubler-Ross spectrum of Spice Girls-related grief when her hopes of meeting not one but two of her girl power idols in the flesh were built up and subsequently crushed on a recent appearance on the Graham Norton Show. Graham Norton Show is based in the UK, and she was there to promote her new movie, obviously, and Graham Norton was talking to her and saying that, oh, it's very rare for not only one, but two Spice Girls to appear in the same place. And the reaction that Emma Stone has is priceless. You really have to go look it up, because it's nothing that I can even explain, because it's just so high dramatic. And I mean, she's been working on her facial expressions for years with acting and everything, but it was just so, I think it was such a pure moment of excitement. And then Graham just squashes all of that and says, well, they're not here. And it's a pretty funny clip. I would definitely recommend going to look it up if you are trying to perk yourself up. In a thrice noted fan of the Picante Troupe, Stone can now add your new favorite Crushed Dreams reaction gift. Stone has a huge compilation of reaction gifts, and it's one of the biggest memes, I'd say, on the internet today, because she is in such a big piece of public eye. And one more thing is that that Emma Stone was really, all she was there to do was to promote the Spider-Man sequel, but that just totally overshadowed it. My next little piece of virality is a story about Drake, the rapper, obviously. He is one that has been in the public eye for a while, just with his work in Degrassi and everything. And then the start of his rap career really was something that people don't take him very seriously, I would say. And so Jimmy Kimmel had him as host the other day, because he is hosting the EPSI Awards. And for a lie witness segment, they had Drake go undercover on the streets of Los Angeles as the behest of Jimmy Kimmel to ask noted Drake haters what they really thought about Drake in light of him hosting the EPSI Awards. Being too in touch with his emotions and being a childish, idiotic, not manly chicken head who isn't a real rapper. This was all stuff that the people on the streets were saying. And it's a really funny segment. If you like Jimmy Kimmel and Drake, you'll definitely enjoy this because it's pretty much a laugh out loud clip. And so the results are another telling lie witness news report filed appropriately enough on the first weekend of Coachella. What would I say to myself? Because I'm Drake, said Drake, responding to a pedestrian who labeled him a total idiot. I am a total idiot to be standing here on the street in this beard and this wig when I know good and well that I am Drake and I could be at home with multiple women bathing in champagne. But instead, I'm interviewing you. Oh boy, still don't get it, huh? That's a little excerpt of the clip, and in it, Drake is talking to this guy who is totally trash-talking him, and when the guy looks away, Drake takes off all of his undercover makeup and everything, and the guy just totally goes ballistic, and it is hilarious. My next quick little story is about a pretty interesting one, I would say, and it's an interview for one of the last survivors of the 1906 earthquake. So over at Hoodline, our friends in the Lower Haight remember the big one via an interview with 108-year-old earthquake survivor Bill Del Monte, who at more than a century old has some astounding stories to tell. Del Monte, who now lives in Marin, was the son of a Fior d'Italia co-owner. The restaurant has its own rich history and was only 3 months old when the quake hit. According to the survivor, his mother wrapped him in tablecloth while she and the rest of his family fled down flame-engulfed Broadway Street to the ferry building to catch a boat across the bay. Bill, who's still spry for 107 years old, tells Hoodline some old memories of various neighborhoods, e.g. attending school in the Mission, swimming at the Sutro Baths, and missing out on the summer love because he was too old to be a part of the counterculture. However, when it comes to the biggest issue looking over contemporary San Francisco, the tech industry, Bill charmingly boils down Silicon Valley to a bunch of guys working in their garages. He is this totally precious old guy, and if you could imagine a picture of him, he kind of looks like the older grandpa in the movie Up, and he's such a happy guy. He tells the interviewer that he's lived such a full and happy life and that he's so thankful for being able to witness it all. And he says, every week they invent something new now. That's why in San Francisco, well, the factories are down in San Jose, but they've run out of room, so they're moving back to San Francisco. They're inventing things that you don't believe. They want to make a watch now, a television watch, a few other things. He's kind of, since he is so old, he kind of rants like that. But that was a little quote from him. And it's such an uplifting little story because if you think about it, we all could live to the age that we can all live to the age that he is at the current moment. And just to think, I've lived 20 years now and there's been so much that happens, like what else could happen in my life and all that. So it's a really great story if you want to be reflective and all that. But my next story is one more about Pharrell Williams, who is totally adorable. And he may have written the happiest song of the year, but Pharrell Williams was reduced to tears during his interview with Oprah Winfrey. The happy singer sat down with the talk show host for an upcoming episode of Oprah Prime on her own network and was moved by a video shown to him of people dancing to his chart-topping song. He asked, "Why am I crying on Oprah?" And he was streaming down tears when he was saying this. And Pharrell, I think he has had such a long career that to see this huge spike all of a sudden, it's really rewarding for him because, yes, he's had successful producing jobs and just song releases, but this one song is worldwide famous, and everyone is listening to it multiple times a day, multiple times, I'd say an hour. I was just driving down to my grandparents the other weekend, and in the span of an hour and a half, I heard the song four times. And I was like, oh my gosh, radio stations, like, what is going on? I mean, I love this song, but it just, I can't escape it. And it's not that I want to, it's just that I don't want it to be overplayed so much that I don't enjoy it. And he says, it's overwhelming because I love what I do, and I just appreciate the fact that people have believed in me for so long that I could make it to this point and feel that. He is totally overwhelmed in emotion, and it is so precious to me. And I think it's awesome that Oprah is the one to be interviewing him, because she is so uplifting and she's so reflective and amazing with her words, and someone to aspire to be, I would say. So with some encouraging words from Oprah, Pharrell, 41, was also shown some pictures from his childhood. During the interview, Williams, wearing one of his many distinctive Vivian Westwood hats, discussed his rise to fame, his songwriting process, and the music that influenced him to become a 7-time Grammy-winning recording artist and producer. Wow, that's such a list of accomplishments, and I think that his career can only get better from here. And he goes on to talk about the process, which is, my best songs come from two different ways. He says, either when I have a really good gut feeling about something, it's written in the shower or a plane. Shower's good, isn't it? Oprah says. There's something about the water. The water attracts your ear, he says. You get distracted and your mind wanders. But for his Despicable Me 2 song, Pharrell called it a crazy half-court shot. It's not because you're that good, Williams says. It's because you're out of ideas. The interview also saw Pharrell talk about his critically acclaimed new album, Girl, and his wedding last year to model and designer Helen LaShawn. But over the weekend, he was in Indio, California to perform at Coachella 2014, where he reminded the audience of just how many hit songs he's been behind. And those were all the performances I was discussing earlier, and he had so many people come out to help support him and sing alongside on stage, and I just really, really enjoy Pharrell at this moment in time. And you can even look up 5 of the best happy videos you have missed worldwide, and it's on BuzzFeed, and it's a great thing to watch because it's all these different cultures singing to and dancing to happy, and it's just so uplifting. And I love the song alone, but when you see all these other cultures getting in on it, it's so crazy that this huge viral mass has occurred over the last couple of months just because of one song. My next story, really quickly before we all go, is one about Justin Bieber. Of course, we have to end on Justin always. And do you remember that petition to deport Justin Bieber hit over 100,000 signatures, but nothing happened? Well, the White House finally addressed the situation on their website with an official response. Thank you for your petition and your participation in We the People. Sorry to disappoint, but we won't be commenting on this one. The We the People terms of participation state that, to avoid the appearance of improper influence, the White House may decline to address certain procurement, law enforcement, adjudicatory, or similar matters properly within the jurisdiction of federal departments or agencies, federal courts or states, and local governments in its response to a petition. So we'll leave it to others to comment on Mr. Bieber's case, but we're glad you care about immigration issues, because our current system is broken. Too many employers game the system by hiring undocumented workers, and 11 million people are living in the shadows. That status quo isn't good for our economy or our country. We need common sense immigration reform to make sure everybody plays by the same set of rules. Not only is it the right thing to do morally, it's the right thing to do for our country. Well, I wouldn't think that a little petition to deport Justin Bieber would have such a deep underlying meaning behind it, and that the government would bring forth such a heavy and deep-rooted topic. So that is my last story for all of you. I hope you all enjoyed the show today, and I'll be back next week. But first, I will also be on tomorrow from 4 to 5 alongside DJ Hafo as we interview Paul Racanello, Dean of Students, for all of those who don't know, but you should be well informed of Paul Racanello. We'll be talking to him all about student affairs and his career and anything that we can really get from him, and it'll be a really fun time. He's a great guy, and I hope that you all tune in. It's tomorrow, 4 to 5, so that's Tuesday, 4 to 5, on Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu, and I'll catch you all tomorrow and then next week for one of my last shows.
Troopers.